Well, welcome to our session. I want to briefly introduce Jack, who most of you, probably everybody knows. Jack...
Not quite.
Okay. Well, everybody should know him and will know me after the end of the session. But aside from teaching religious studies here and being an excellent colleague over many years, Jack has done tours to India. Well, he did a sabbatical in India, got hooked on India, although India got into his liver a bit more than he had wanted for a while. And since that time, he has then been taking students also to explore the diversity of India. And so within India, two significant contexts that sort of shape part of this is with Dalit, Jack will explain that, people and theologians, and on the other hand, broad exposure to Hinduism. So those have been two interests, as well as eco-theology has been another major interest, and Jack has taught justice theologies. But taking students to get an exposure to what, after all, is a gigantic part of our world has been amazing. And so we look forward to hearing you today, and then everybody will know you at the end of this.
Thank you. Well, I'm honored that you've come to think with me around this issue of the status of Dalits in India. And I look forward to the conversation afterwards, because there's lots to talk about. I don't consider myself really an expert in Dalit theology. I'm sort of, over the years, having been to India about 8 or 9 times now, someone who has listened in on the conversations that Dalits are having about their own status. And so I'm going to, basically, what I'm sharing with you is that perspective. So let me begin by, I'm going to read this, but hopefully not in a boring way, boring you or me. And I may stop and interject periodically as well. Let me try to say who the Dalits of India are. And I wish that was an easier task than it turned out to be, because there's a lot of controversy around the name Dalit and who uses it and for what purposes. Then I'll talk about Indian Christianity generally and the social location of Dalit Christians within it, within the broader category of Dalit, as well as what unique challenges Dalit Christians face, so I've heard, both in reading and talking to Dalits, as many of you have too. So who are the Dalits? Estimates are that there are about 200 million impoverished persons in India, popularly referred to as Dalits. 200 million, so that's a huge number of people. Most of them are Hindu Dalits, though some have converted to more egalitarian traditions like Christianity, Buddhism, Islam, and Sikhism, yet while still retaining the self-attribution of Dalit. So they're Dalit Sikhs, Dalit Christians, Dalit Muslims, and so on. Traditionally, Hindu Dalits, the vast majority still today, have been called the untouchables, a term that describes their status quite literally, and the term that we're probably most familiar with. There's a series of videos that I'd order for the library, that are, if you ever want to pursue further this issue of the untouchables, these are hard to watch. There's 5 of them, but they're wonderful in terms of bringing to light the plight of Dalits in India today. So the term untouchables is pretty good because it describes their status. They pollute on touch. They pollute if their shadow falls on you. And they pollute if they look at you. Traditionally, a high caste girl is to immediately wash her eyes if she happens to see a Dalit. Now, I need to just add something here, and that is that for middle to upper class Indians who are Hindu, they might take offense at what I just said. And say, for example, that, that's 100 years ago. That's 200 years ago. Those are ancient traditions that have nothing to do with Hinduism today. And that, honoring that assertion, yes, I would, I guess. But it also stands in stark tension and contrast with what people, some of the people you've met, like Luther, Paul, and Jancy, would assert, and that is prejudice and discrimination against the Dalits is yet very real, quite viscerally felt, and not in the background, but on the surface of social life in India today. Their very being, therefore, carries a taint, a desecrating effect. The notion of pollution, which is an odd notion when you think about it, that they embody is ontological, meaning it has to do with the essence of their being. They are vile in their very nature, traditionally. See, I never know whether to add that little caveat. Traditionally, currently, a little bit of both. Traditionally, currently. They pollute physically, religiously, and socially. Historically, in majority rural India, that is where historically most people have lived in India, though urbanization is transforming India in a phenomenal way. Now I think currently it's about 50% rural, 50% urban. Historically in majority India, they were forced to live on the outskirts of the village, away from the best land, the best water, and the better people, though it sounds nasty to say, the caste Hindus. They were never allowed to drink water from public wells or drink the same cups in tea stalls, drink from the same cups in tea stalls. And certainly they didn't have any political, economic, or social status. Anecdote after anecdote comes to mind. We visited some temples, Luther, Paul, and I, in Kanchipuram, a city in the south, a famous temple city and also famous for its silk, Kanchipuram silk. And he said, "Sir, you go into that temple, I can't go." He had gone into a lot of temples prior that he was a bit fearful about going into, but had no trouble, I think, because of my status as a whitey, carrying that with him. But in this one, he didn't want to go in, so he stayed out. So the prohibition of entering certain sacred spaces by Dalits is longstanding and current, not just historical. They were born to be landless farm laborers, so now some of the things that they do. Farm laborers, butchers, washers, dobi walla, toilet cleaners, tanners, scavengers, street sweepers, rock chippers, and carcass handlers. One of the India tours, Luther Paul took us to the outskirts of Hyderabad, where these rock formations stand, and some of the people that he had been working with are rock chippers, so they go out with a sledgehammer. I've got a picture at the end, I'll show you. A sledgehammer, and they break down huge granite boulders into gravel-like pieces. No eyeglasses, barefoot for the most part, and that's their lot in life that they were born into. In terms of religious status within the Hindu caste system, which I'll talk about in a moment, they have none, no status. They couldn't enter into caste Hindu temples, I've mentioned that, were prevented from learning the sacred Hindu language of Sanskrit. And if they were unfortunate enough to even hear the sacred texts, now here I could say this is traditionally, I think, not currently, known as the Vedas, being read or chanted, they'd have molten lead poured into their ears and mouth, put to death, in other words. Okay, the word Dalit itself is Marathi from the state of Maharashtra in India. And again, it quite literally describes the status. It means crushed or broken to pieces. And is the word now preferred by most of these 200 million unfortunate outcasts, at least by those intent on some form of social advocacy. And there is a mentality of passivity amongst many in the midst of their impoverishment. So not all are socially activists, but those that want to put their plight to the fore, we're Dalits. They want the world to know, or at least the caste people in India to know, that they are crushed. That is their status. The word Dalit, therefore, has somewhat of a militant, even abrasive, in-your-face connotation. In 1988, for example, the National Commission for Scheduled Tribes and I'll have to elaborate on what scheduled means, labeled the term Dalit unconstitutional, asking that it no longer be used in government circles, which is currently the case, I believe. The designation that now rules the day is scheduled castes and scheduled tribes, used in official government documentation, at least at the central level. The image that came to mind for me, just on the side, trying to figure all of this out was like trying being in a snowstorm and trying to catch one particular snowflake. In terms of variable interpretations and ideologically not tainted but shaped convictions, anyway, now the term scheduled caste. It's often used synonymously for Dalits at the official government levels, referring to the almost 15% of India's 1.3 billion people who are entirely outside of the caste system. Now, they are scheduled in that the government in 1950, in an effort at affirmative action, allocated to them constitutional guarantees in regards to political representation, and I think it's at both the state and federal level, government jobs, both, and educational placements. And one of the things that you soon realize in India is the competitive nature of the educational system, given there are so many people like ants, not to say this, well, trying to crawl over each other to get placements in especially some of the top schools. So it should be noted that to complicate matters, okay, here's another kind of footnote. Some states have other official names to refer to these scheduled caste Dalits. Now, this is important in a way. In the southern states of Tamil Nadu, Karnataka, and Andhra Pradesh, three southern states, for example, Dalits are respectively referred to as Adi Dravida, Adi Karnataka, and Adi Andhra. Now, the Adi prefix, A-D-I, is important because it refers to the assumption made by many, Dalits in particular themselves, that these are the original people of India, because Adi means original. So you've got, and here's the snowstorm again, you've got some Dalits and Dalit scholars asserting they are the aboriginals of India, but then you've got the tribals. So what do you do with the tribals? Aren't they the aboriginals? So I asked Imi, Luther Paul's son, on the phone the other day to clarify this for me. He did his best. He said, well, the tribals live in the forests, and the Dalits usually don't live in the forests. You think about that. I doubt if they're the same. They dress differently. There's different cultural heritages, for sure. So, the untouchables call themselves Dalits, much to the chagrin of officialdom, even today, because it pushes caste Hindus to think about and deal with this huge community of oppressed millions. And that's an assertion made by Sati Clark, who became a friend at United Theological College in Bangalore, India, and his family and our family spend a lot of time together. He has his PhD from Harvard in contemporary theology, studying under Kaufman, I think it is. Kaufman. And then he decided to move his family and take up the cause of Dalit theology, though he himself is not a Dalit. Anyway, and secondly, it's also a term, Dalits, that's beginning to conjure hope amongst the masses in India today and is central to what is a growing Dalit liberation movement. So what I've been reading is that liberation theology, some of you might be familiar with it, coming out of Latin America, it's sort of the voice of the poor and the theology that they're doing on their own behalf, seeing Jesus as a revolutionary liberator. Indian Dalit theologians are looking there and saying, yes, that's kind of what we want to do, but their situation is socioeconomic class structure is the problem, so a Marxist analysis is applicable. But for us, class structure is not the issue. Caste structure is the issue, which is unique to India. So they're doing a liberation theology that struggles with the caste issue as the primary generator of inequity in India. Just as a note, in the 1930s, Mahatma Gandhi called these 200 million untouchables the Harijans, the children of God. Today, this title, I was surprised to find out, doesn't sit well with Dalits because of its infantilizing connotation. Remember, most are Hindu, so it has sort of a missionizing ring to it, I think, in their ears. They also don't like the term Harijans because Gandhi never attacked forthrightly enough the injustices of the Indian caste system, thus subtly legitimizing their oppression, at least from their perspective. He never advocated, and I think this is true, that I'm not an expert on Gandhi, the full abolishment of the caste system, which some in the 40s and 50s were arguing for. One in particular I'll note. We should note as well that in 1950, the Constitution of India made it illegal to discriminate against people on the basis of untouchability. So, what, 50 years ago and some, it was made illegal. Especially under the leadership of Dr. B.R. Ambedkar. Some of you may have heard of him. You drive through villages in southern India especially, and there's a statue in the circle, you know, where traffic circles around, of Ambedkar, with his hand out, making a point, and is really revered by Dalits throughout India. He was an untouchable Hindu who converted to Buddhism and took thousands with him as a direct affront to the caste system. Okay, having said in a cursory way and all too inadequate who the Dalits are, let me turn to what's probably the major factor legitimizing their ongoing marginalization, the Hindu caste system. The caste system has mythological origins in a story found in the Rig Veda, the earliest and most important of the Hindu scriptures, written about 1500 BCE, the Rig Vedas. In it, the gods sacrifice a primeval man called Purusha, and from the different parts of his body come the four major castes. Here's what the Rig Veda says. When they divided the man, into how many parts did they apportion him? What do they call his mouth, his two arms and thighs and feet? His mouth became the Brahmin. His arms were made into the warrior. His thighs the people, and from his feet the servants were born. End of quote. The Brahmins, therefore, are the highest caste. They learn and teach the Vedas. Second come the Kshatriyas, or the warriors or rulers, who protect society as kings and rulers. Third, there's the Vaishyas. These are the cattle herders, the traders, the agriculturalists. And finally, fourth are the Shudras, who are the servants of the above three. And we have to talk quite a bit about the Shudras and their status. They are the lowest in the hierarchy, the fourth caste, and officially referred to as the other backward castes, OBCs. Indians love acronyms. OBCs. So they're the servants of the other three higher castes. We haven't even talked about Dalits, remember, they're lower down yet. They're outside of the caste system, maybe. Depends on who you look at, what interpreter you're hearing from. So the OBCs, the other backward castes, are not part of the upper three twice-born caste groups. And we should note that the Shudras, this fourth caste group, make up anywhere from 20 to 50% of India's population. So India is almost majority Shudras, servant caste. They are what Gerald Larson, in his excellent book called India's Agony Over Religion, I love that title because it's so true to what's happening. Says they are, the Shudras, the bullock capitalists, the self-employed agrarian peasant class. Now, self-employed sounds good. Peasant class doesn't sound so good. And their lot is quite sad as well. They own a couple of bullocks and a small plot of land. They may make up about 30% of rural households and control over 50% of the land in India. But they're peasants. They're very poor. These are the people you'll see behind a bullock pulling a plow still in rural India, even though there is massive industrialized farming. The caste system, therefore, is the underpinning of a religiously legitimized, absolutely fixed, ideal hierarchical society in which each caste in its prescribed roles sustains the whole. Ideal in the sense that you know your place in life. You've been born into it. You don't have to struggle with vocation. It's pretty well given to you by birth. And of course, ideal, especially from the upper caste perspective, because there's lots of people to help you do what you're supposed to do. In Sanskrit, the word caste is jati, which actually means, and this is interesting, kind or species. So within any given social unit, such as a village, there'll be members of one or more of these species of human beings. Though complications arise when you also have subcastes, sub-subcastes, and on. And trying to figure out the caste system in detail is that snowstorm again. Now notice there's no mention of Dalits thus far in this, or untouchables within this caste hierarchy. They are completely outside of the system. They're therefore considered lower than the servants, the Shudras. And again, a note about the Shudras. In 1991, an infamous report called the Mundal Report was commissioned by the central government of India. And its recommendations, which were subsequently accepted, set off a firestorm of protest across India among the three higher castes, the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, and the Vaishyas. They're called the forward castes, as they're called, with some even committing suicide by self-immolation among members of this, these three higher castes because of this Mundal report. They were enraged by the Mundal report giving this exceedingly large group of Indians, the Shudras, up to 50%, which make up to 50% of India's population, 27% of all schedules or reservations, government jobs, school placements, and so on. Again, the poor Indian government trying to entertain yet another program of affirmative action on behalf of this fourth servant caste to uplift them, the other backward castes, OBCs, to give them educational, political, and job concessions. The three forward castes, therefore, were ironically apoplectic that they were being unduly discriminated against because of their high social status. They had no reservations. Let's see, he's not here yet. Varghese promised me he'd be here, but he was rushing back from Edmonton, having grown up in India. But some of you might have experience of this as well. Gerald Larson notes that the chief reason the Mundal report was so contentious was not only because it implemented affirmative action on behalf of the Shudras, but even more so because it dared to assert that the Shudra social and educational backwardness was due primarily not to economic disadvantage, but to, quote, the heritage of a hierarchical social order built largely on a religious understanding of caste, whereby people, groups of people, were systematically discriminated against on grounds of ritual purity and rendered incapable of competing are functioning in a fair and equitable manner. End of quote. So the Mundell Report laid it on the line, basically attacking this historically entrenched, religiously legitimized inequity that is the caste system. It dared to say what everyone knew, that impoverishment, backwardness, and servitude of perhaps, now we're including the Shudras, 500 million people was due to the caste system. This was an amazingly bold, though self-evident assertion in a country that still today, I would venture, guess, don't know for sure, takes for granted the belief that people are born into certain preordained stations in life. People are born with certain predilections, in Sanskrit called adhikaras, determined by past karma, for doing only certain things in life, like preventing caste Hindus from becoming ritually polluted by performing tasks that involve, for example, contact with blood or dead bodies of humans and animals. I tried to find a story that you may have even as well come across. There was a cyclone near Bangladesh and also hit India. And there was a story about how the untouchables refused to pick up all the bodies. And there was chaos. They were concerned about what's the disease you get from dead bodies? Cholera.
Cholera
spreading through a very tight-knit population, densely populated. In fact, Dalits have clashed with caste Hindus in recent times over the growing realization, and you'd think they would know this all along, but that doing these things, like picking up dead bodies and things having to do with human excrement and blood and so on, makes them unclean, which is the reason for their being shunned by the high castes. In summary then, up to 60%, so it's 50-60% of India's 1.3 billion people have educational and job concessions or reservations, at least on paper. There's another wrinkle of complexity. You've got a reservation, try to get it fulfilled, try to get your rightful designation into a school for your children, for example. Dalits receive about 22.5% of these. And the affirmative action is deemed warranted because, as the Mundell Report recognized, the caste system has, and this is a key issue, I think this is a large part of the problem, has conditioned the consciousness of the lower caste, Shudras, and the outcasts, the Dalits, to accept their inferior status in the ritual hierarchy as part of the natural order of things. So caste lives in the head, both in terms of high caste and all of the castes. And so it's hard to eradicate just by laws. It has endured for over 3,000 years, and even today Larson asserts, quote, there appears to be no symptoms of its early demise. And this is something we debate on the India tour all the time. And we try to investigate it, but it's kind of a touchy issue. It's like racism. What do you invent? Are you a racist? It's hard to get at. But, But, question remains, are Dalits originally part of the Hindu caste system, given there's no mention of them in the primeval man mythology, Purusha? Some commentators, especially Hindu, insist that they are. They are the Panchamas. Ek, do, teen, char, panch. That's as high as I can count in Hindi. Panch is five. So they're the Panchamas, the fifth caste, sort of drawn into the caste system. They are destined to do the jobs that even Shudras won't do. Some of those jobs I've listed. But then there's those such as Sati Clark, the Christian scholar I mentioned, a Christian Dalit scholar, that he studies Dalits, though he himself is not a Dalit, who argue that Dalits are completely outside, quote, of human society as defined by the Hindu system. So he says they're not part of it. Rather, they are the original people of India, who, before Hinduism entered India, had their own indigenous folk traditions with their own primeval gods and goddesses. And then through a process of Hindu cultural colonization, these gods and goddesses were absorbed into the Hindu pantheon as minor deities, subordinate to the major Hindu deities, and yet now fully under Brahmanical ritual control of the Brahmins. An example pointed to by one commentator is Murugan, and I've been to some of the temples where he's worshipped, an Adi Dravidian. But notice, Sati Clark calls Murugan an Adi Dravidian, an original, a god of the original peoples of India, who then is renamed Skanda, who becomes a son of Shiva and Parvati, two of the major deities in Hinduism. So a process of cultural absorption. And that's very important in terms of a growing waking up of Dalits, that they may have had at one time their own religious traditions, and they've been co-opted. Along with this religious colonization also came cultural colonization, where Dalits were allocated the most demeaning and polluting vocations and rituals, such as, and one can just go on in sort of the text of terror reading these vocations that they do, manual scavenging. I'll show you some. What is manual scavenging? I'm not sure. It means picking up things off the street, rags. You've got rag pickers. I'll show you some images of them. Digging into the dumps and so on, and then selling the rags and plastics, but also cleaning up human excrement in dry toilets, which still exists today, though they've been outlawed again for probably 40, 50 years, but they're still there. Temple prostitution, temple, sacred place, prostitution, how does that work together? It's a long story. You would, as a deeply impoverished family, and you have the unfortunate birth of a girl child, you'd take her to the temple and give her at the age of, well, you'd probably give her at the age of 5 or 6, and then take her home until she's about 12 or 13, and then she returns to the temple and she becomes the married to the goddess, or married to the god, I guess it would be, not the goddess, and becomes a prostitute within the temple. Finally, some scholars point to evidence within Hindu sacred texts themselves that gives witness to the violent historical takeover of Dalit tribal traditions. And this was interesting because this was new to me. The theory is, of course, that that Hinduism came into India from the southern steppes of Russia, brought in by the Aryans. So it was probably their religion. And then it mixed with the indigenous peoples of India, transformed itself, and lo and behold, the indigenous peoples of India became the servants of the lighter-skinned Aryans. So the Atharva Veda, for example, reads like this. So here's a quote from the Atharva Veda. O Indra, one of the high gods of the Vedas, Soma, I'm not sure if that's synonymous name with Indra. Soma is usually referred to as a sacred drink that is taken by the priests and gives them an intoxicated ability to enter into the presence of the gods. O Indra, Soma, burn the Asuras, the indigenous. Burn, crush them. Torture them who increase in tens and hundreds in dark forests. Cut them into pieces. Let their children die and let the earth swallow their generation. So you get a feel there for some kind of cultural takeover and appropriation of indigenous peoples. Numerous other examples of militaristic conquest of Dalit indigenous traditions are found in the great Hindu epic, the Ramayana. If any of you love Tolkien, that sort of genre of literature, the Ramayana is for you. Where the great ruler, God ruler Ram, who is an incarnation of Vishnu, one of the great high gods of Hinduism, destroys the Asuras of the forest, the greatest of all being Ravana of Sri Lanka. Okay, now let me turn more explicitly to Christianity in India. Gerald Larson, in his book, India's Agony Over Religion, which I've mentioned, says that about 2.34% of India's population, is Christian. I don't know how many Christians there are in India. I've heard 5%, 2%, 3%, 4%. I don't know who's counting. Maybe only. 2.34% anyway. In 1996, Larson's book was published, so it's a bit outdated, I'm sure. Christianity has trouble advancing in India. And I can talk about as to what my theory is as to why. Even though there's millions and millions of dollars of foreign mission monies being pumped into India all the time. So, 2.34%, about 24 million Christians, made up of about 17.3 million Catholics, 8 million Protestants, so Catholics are in the majority, 8 million Protestants, and 2.5 million Orthodox of various kinds. And that's Martoma Syrian Church of Malabar, about 1.5 million Syrian Orthodox or Thomas Christians. Borghese would be able to explain to us a little bit about that. 60% of all of India's Christians are found in three states. So India, Christianity is very much concentrated in India. It's not dispersed throughout, even though it's quite a small 2.34%. In Kerala, the state from which Borghese Mandalore is from, or at least his parents, Andhra Pradesh, Luther Paul and Jhansi are from that state, and Tamil Nadu, just south of Andhra Pradesh. Sati Clark, the Indian Christian scholar mentioned earlier, makes a provocative distinction between Indian Christians and Dalit Christians. Indian Christians, he suggests, are caste Christians, converts to Christianity from one of the four Hindu castes, while Dalit Christians are converts from the Dalit ranks, those Panchimas, or out-of-caste people. Now, the reason why this distinction is important is because between 50 to 80% of all Christians in India, and I think most agree on this, but again, notice the spread, 50 to 80%, were originally Hindu Dalits. So, yeah. Yet, he suggests this fact, that most of the Indians sitting in the pews in the Christian churches were originally Hindu Dalits, is ignored for the most part by Indian Christianity generally. I'll get to why. He suggests that this fact is largely ignored within the churches for two reasons. The first is that Dalits themselves have, quote, officially disassociated from or completely disowned much of their own native religious symbolic world. We've actually come into contact with some of this native Dalit symbolic religious world here in Camrose. Can anybody guess in what form? A piece of material culture auctioned off at one of the Sahakarini suppers. What?
Sandals.
The sandals? No, that's no. The drum. The Dalit drum, which is a polluting instrument because it's of cowhide. And it's so touching death, it makes you polluted, and only Dalits can drum it. And also, it's banned from most of the churches in India because of that. The reason for this disassociation is clearly explained by an Anglican bishop of Madras who in 1921 wrote these words, that the aim of converting Dalits to Christianity was to, and you can see why they've lost their indigenous roots, cut down the jungles of beliefs and practices, rites and ceremonies of the Dalits, and clear the ground for the teaching and worship of the Christian church. When the outcasts of a village in the Telugu country become Christian, they very often level the shrine of their local deity to the ground and build a Christian prayer house on the site. So that they've lost the sense of having had at one time their own religious traditions, non-Christian, of course, but non-Hindu as well, is understandable. The second reason as to why it's largely ignored that most Christians have Dalit origins is that church leadership in theology was and still is dominated by high caste converts to Christianity, or what Clark calls Indian Christians. The result is that these high caste converts have perpetuated a type of Christianity that wed together their former high caste Brahmanical Hinduism and their newfound Christian faith, not wedding their newfound Christian faith with Dalit origins. Largely oblivious then to this wedding, largely oblivious to the Dalit origins of the majority. Indigenous Indian theology, that is that theology now that's being done by Indians themselves within their own context, not just borrowed mission theology, indigenous Indian theology is done then from the perspective and for the welfare of caste Christians. Now you might be sensing some tension, because there's some tension then within the church itself. Centrally concerned about indigenization and adaptation to Hindu culture, caste Christian theology emphasized interiority, an enlightenment-like quest for salvation, reflective of the high caste Hindu ideals found within the Hindu philosophy of Vedanta. Put simply, enlightenment, becoming enlightened. Having a special knowing about the essence of your being, being divine, and so on. It gave rise then to an inward-looking, otherworldly pietism, lacking Christian social justice activist mandates, especially relevant to the majority in the pews who are of Dalit background and significantly still oppressed even within Christianity, but I'll talk about that towards the end, and the end is nigh. M.E. Prabhakar, because I do want to give us as much time as possible, a Protestant theologian teaching at Gurukul Seminary in Chennai, concurs with Clark's observation that Dalit Christians are subject to casteism within the church itself. This is amazing when you think about it. Suffering social oppression and discrimination at the hands of the so-called upper caste Christians. The pernicious effect of Hindu caste is present in Indian Christianity, Prabhakar concludes. The reason is that the egalitarian anti-caste ideals have been eroded enough to allow caste distinctions and practices to be tolerated within the Indian Christian fellowship. One Lutheran pastor told me, for example, that still today in rural Andhra Pradesh, there are churches just for Vaishyas. They're Christians, but they carry with them still their Vaishya designation. And there are churches for Dalits, and they don't mix. At mixed gatherings, when there are mixed gatherings, the high caste sit in chairs, and the Dalits sit on the floor. And each accepts their own role. At the same time, and I don't think I've mentioned this yet, the Dalit Christians, along with all Christians in India, now this is an important factor. So all Christians in India, Dalit or caste Christians, doesn't matter, are subject to yet another layer of discrimination. The central government discriminates them against them by excluding them from scheduled caste status. So if you convert to Sikhism, Buddhism, or Islam, as a Dalit, you're a Muslim Dalit, Buddhist Dalit, and so on, you get reservation. Christian? No way. So, yeah, another layer of significant discrimination. As a minority community, Christians of all stripes, Dalit or otherwise, are disallowed from receiving the economic benefits of reservation. And when Christians complain, get this, Dalit Christians in particular, when they complain and advocate on their own behalf for inclusion in the reservation system, which they are right now, and there is some movement maybe on the part of the central government, but there seems to be always a movement, always a promise, but it never happens. They get no sympathy from those already in the reservation system, because you don't want more reservations, especially the Hindu Dalits, who form the majority, because they're accused of already receiving, the Dalits, Christians, of receiving missionary patronage for many, many years. And they do, right? Anyone who converts to Christianity in India, therefore, immediately loses any reservation privilege they may have had in their former caste. And these reservations are deemed necessary for social advancement given the tenacious presence of ongoing caste discrimination throughout India. Okay, especially in rural regions. And this is where everything's changing, right? With urbanization, caste discrimination, I think I've given into this argument, is diminishing significantly. But why is that? I was thinking, Gwynne Dyer gave a lecture here a number of years ago. He's a military historian and a Canadian journalist. And his thesis was that globalization is the best thing that would have ever hit the developing world. And his argument was that because CNN will be watched, Baywatch will be watched, people in the poorest regions of the world will be watching television. You know, all of us, a liberal thinker like I go, what? You don't have any criticism of globalization, you nuts. But I'm wondering, you know, the cities are the brunt, or they receive the brunt of the globalizing forces. And so maybe that breaking down of sharp caste distinctions is somewhat a consequence of seeing the rest of the world. Conclusion. So, are Dalits better off having converted to Christianity, even though they're discriminated against by having no chance of reservations, at least at this time? I don't know. I can't say. But it's a good question. Let me speculate. On the one hand, they're probably better off since they come out from under the heavy weight, and I hopefully I've impressed you with that, the heavy weight of caste hierarchical oppression into the bright light of Christian egalitarianism. And I don't say that facetiously. We're all are equal before the eyes of God. We ought, those of us inside and outside of Christianity, ought never forget how distinct that assertion is. At least theoretically, within the churches, it's asserted. Yet at the same time, that sense of equality is compromised by the ongoing presence, and it's almost like something dragged behind, of caste prejudice within the churches. Then again, a Hindu scholar told me years ago that he admired Christianity. This was a lecture I gave up in the north. He says, I really admire you Christians. I was giving a lecture on religion and ecology. I admire Christianity for its ethic of love of neighbor, which he thought was lacking in Hinduism because of its ethos of fatedness, karmic fatedness. That is, that you are what you are because of past karmic deeds. And you do get a sense of, as you walk through the Indian world, of things are just laissez-faire. The beggar's a beggar because they ought to be a beggar. And I hope they're a good beggar, and the next life they might not be a beggar if they're a good beggar. No. So it's like, let me out of here. Finally, Christians, Dalit Christians especially, are caught in the crossfires of a multiplicity of what I think are culture wars that are raging in India. For example, they're being pressured to convert back to Hinduism. The Hindutva movement within India, which is sort of the fundamentalist Hindu movement, which is in some ways an oxymoron, but it is. They're pressured to convert back to Hinduism in order to gain the benefits of reservation, which are accorded to the poorest of Hindus, as I've noted, as well, but not Christians or Muslims. And they're also subject on and off to an outright assault by right-wing Hindu movements who fan the flames of hatred. A 1991 Human Rights Watch report entitled Politics by Other Means, Attacks Against Christians in India, accused the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, they're not in now, thank heavens, but they were in the 90s, which was in power for a number of years beginning in March 98, accused them of having fanned the flames of violence against Christians by exploiting communal tensions for political ends, especially in the state of Gujarat. We're going there to Gujarat, where priests were killed, nuns raped. Jeez, we'll talk about it. And Christian churches, colleges, and cemeteries were attacked, and thousands of Christians forced to convert back to Hinduism. And Dalit Christians, as noted, are subject to discrimination within the Christian church itself. One Lutheran pastor told me that foreign church support was not coming to his school because the money was being appropriated unjustly by a church official at another school who had a higher social status. He was a caste Christian, while the Lutheran pastor was a Dalit Christian. The same Lutheran pastor claimed he'd never become bishop because he was a Dalit. Internal church politics, I heard, were also not without their violence, with at times lives actually being threatened. Dalit Christians are also subject to caste discrimination from caste Hindus who still fear touching a Dalit. For example, a Dalit Christian pastor told me that money for work performed would never be given to him in his hand, but always laid on the table because of the fear of being touched. And this is today. It was also pointed out to me that current Telugu textbooks in Andhra Pradesh, school textbooks contain a paragraph in the beginning warning teachers and students against caste discrimination and abuse. The point being that this paragraph wouldn't be required if caste discrimination wasn't still a real issue in Andhra Pradesh. One final thought. Christians may be better off in India today, not so much because of Christian theologies or practices, but because of exposure to Christian missionaries from the West who brought with them, embedded in their often triumphalistic theologies, the more recent Western cultural assumption that men and women are equal. This conviction concerning male-female equality is also being carried into India by the introduction of globalization, foreign television, films, where Indians see repeatedly women performing tasks equal to men. Dr. Luke, many of you who know or met, a Christian doctor and evangelical, when he was here a few years ago, told me that the one thing that shocked him the most during his visit was the high status women were accorded in our society. A female hospital administrator showing him through St. Mary's. That impressed him. Subsequently, he committed himself to elevate the status of women in the context of the work that he's doing in Andhra Pradesh. Women in India today still struggle desperately for any sense of equality or even justice. So I've got to say something about women. Dalit women especially are referred to as the Dalits of the Dalits. The most crushed of the crushed. They're subject to mental and physical abuse, deemed fated to servitude just because they've been born a woman. Again, an unfortunate consequence of bad past karma. One Dalit woman told me that even though her husband currently has a secure job with considerable income and she had two grown sons, she still feared that if he died before her, she'd become destitute and out on the street, struggling to survive. Like caste prejudice, misogyny is still operative in India, with widows viewed as inauspicious, which is a nice way of saying they're of no use to anyone, even their children. Worse yet, they're also seen as dangerous to be around because they're often blamed for the death of their husband and therefore certainly shouldn't remarry because they'd only end up cursing their next husband as well. It's a bad omen to pass a widow. So widow ashrams are prevalent in India where widows go to die, often in desperate despair and abandonment, shunned by their families, both immediate and in-laws. They're forbidden to wear makeup, colored clothing or bangles. They're cultural outcasts. And to give birth to a female baby is still an unlucky event in India, with female fetuses being aborted at a frightening rate, given the sex identification technologies available to the growing middle class. A woman's life is fulfilled by having sons, not daughters. And her husband is to be treated as a god and even worshipped, not to speak of the dowry, which is often required to sell a girl child into marriage, often at a ridiculously early age. So if the exposure to the West brings different and more egalitarian assumptions about the status of women, and if Western Christian missionaries mediate these assumptions, as perhaps other mechanisms of globalization do, then Christians, certainly Christian Indian women, and especially Dalit Christian women, may very well be better off. But like caste prejudice, the degree to which these lingering cultural archaisms still prevail, even in Indian Christian circles, is an open question, definitely worthy of further inquiry. And I just want to make a plug for the film series coming up Saharini's Interworld Education and Development Association, in cooperation with the U of A. First film is tonight, but I wanted to mention it because of the film The Forgotten Woman, which deals with the current plight of widows in India. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry I sped up there at the end.
Can I ask you, Jack, to kick this off, to elaborate a little bit on the question of karma? You talked about the Dalits being ontologically polluted,
mm-hmm.
that they're vile in nature.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that's from a classical Hindu perspective.
Mm-hmm.
In a religious system that understands the soul to migrate based on previous actions, karma,
mm-hmm.
in a religious system that sees one moving up and down the karmic ladder, even becoming an animal.
Hells and heavens.
Yeah.
And spend time in.
Yeah. Or becoming God. Could you elaborate just a little bit more on your emphasis was sort of the sociological part of this, which I appreciate. But could you say just a little bit more about how in that Hindu understanding of the movement of the soul and karma, how that is understood in connection with the Dalits? At one point I wasn't sure that they had a soul.
Oh, I hear it. Yeah, okay. I'm not sure if I can, Dave. I mean, a student's asked me, you know, about the notion of reincarnation. How does it happen? It's all very ethereal. I'm not sure.
You don't know.
I'm just thinking, what do I know about karma? Karma is... it's almost like a residue.
Yeah.
That weighs itself.
Seeds.
Yeah, on your soul.
Sure.
And drags you down in that samsaric cycle to lower forms. And
but the Hindus that I know.
Yeah.
And you know, you
say what you have
said. I said something about this already. The Hindus, many of the Hindus that I've talked to, they are. They really, you touched on this, they really have this sense that just because you happen to have some appetite in this life that isn't particularly opening you to higher forms of life and intelligence, if you, for example, suffer from gluttony or greed or something of the sort, the general attitude is... Well, that's unfortunate. That's not a good thing. And if it's in your family, you'd be troubled by it. But it's something they're working on, and they may not get through it in this life. They may not get through it in 10,000 kalpas. But eventually, they'll get through it.
Mm-hmm.
You seem to be framing the Dalits in, well, I'm really wondering this. Are you framing them in some way other than that?
No, I think they solidly fit within that scenario.
They're just at the very bottom.
Just at the very
and
bottom.
And the sociological part of it really freezes them thoroughly.
It freezes them, but not completely, as you're saying. So to be a good Dalit, I don't know what that would mean. It would mean maybe to accept your servitude and do it well.
Uh-huh.
And to make sure you wear a spittle pan around your face. So you don't spit traditionally again, currently, I don't know. So your spit isn't stepped on or encountered by anybody else. So you simply perform those and you hope. This notion of rebirth is David Kinsley put it into context for me when I was struggling to try to understand it. He was a Hindu scholar at McMaster. There's millions and millions and millions of lives you're going to live.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what engenders into Hindu society this stunning, from the Western perspective, sense of passivity. Don't worry. Be happy. Or work on your mm-hmm. your little agenda of being as good a person as you can be as you were born. This notion of predisposition and born with certain predispositions. Yeah, you may be born gluttonous. Try to curtail it. It's not necessarily bad. Mm-hmm. Though it isn't going to destroy you in one life. I guess maybe that's the issue. But no, I don't think the Dalit Hindus would see themselves as forever trapped,
mm-hmm.
but yet affirm karmic advancement,
mm-hmm.
but not in any one lifetime.
Just a little footnote to that. I noticed that you said that the Adi, the whole notion of origin.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? The central concept in Hindu theology of anadi, no origin or rebirth. There is no birth, there's only rebirth.
Yeah.
So that was part of what was behind it too. I was wondering if it was an entirely different way in which that was understood. Mm. But thanks so much.
Yeah. Next.
How you frame the question, whatever has pretended to be, it's been of the benefit. So in terms of, material or social status or whatever, or it may not have, it's probably hard unless you live with the community long enough. What has it done for their sense of identity?
It being what again?
Being Christianity.
Oh, being Christian.
Because if this is the model in which they have grown up, of course, a lot of them are born into Christianity by now, but with that shape, you said, okay, yeah, well, supposedly they affirm we're all equal, so we're all, I guess, mm-hmm. equal of worth or something.
In the eyes of God.
Yeah, so does that
not
happen?
Not sociologically.
No, well, not as others see them, but do they see themselves differently because of being whatever, image of God or whatever language they would use?
You know, I asked Emmy, who's a young pastor, just the other day, yesterday I phoned him. And I asked, because I somehow had got onto the program and I was going to address this question of whether Christians are better on it. Anyway, I said, are Christians, what do Christians gain, what do Hindus gain when they convert to Christianity? What do they get? And he said, not a lot. Well, because they suddenly step outside the reservation system, so it's a big hit.
And they only get one life.
Yeah, and they only get one life. That's a good point. Rather than millions. That's a major loss.
You got to get it all done quick.
Right. But we have, just as a side note on that, the notion of reincarnation, I think, is misappropriate in the West because we think many kicks at the can is a good thing. But for them, it means you get old and you suffer and you lose everything you love and you die. So there's a sense of pathos about that repetitiveness. But anyway, what Emmy said was, he said, people feel themselves Christian when they convert to Christianity more whole, and they feel more healthy and feel more, he didn't use the word ennobled, I forget what word he used, but so for the, in terms of their, and he said the benefits are spiritual. Now, what he meant by that, I don't know.
Have you tried to understand what Hindu Dalits would say about them?
About converting, or?
Well, whether they feel whole.
No. I'm sure they feel crushed. Though, I don't know. It's certainly, like, they perform important ritual rituals within the Hindu system. And there must be a sense of fulfillment that comes, a social location that gives them a sense of belonging and so on. Like carrying the drum and beating it in festivals where nobody, no high caste would hold it. But it's important.
I wanted to make a comment on the idea of globalization having an effect on some of these issues, particularly for women. I was told by several people while I was in India that the influence of globalization on many young women has been quite profound, in that there is a generation of well-educated women who are getting jobs in the high-tech sector, in call centers in different places, and it's really upsetting to some extent their traditional roles within society, because it subverts in a way the dowry system, because if you have an education and a job, then you don't have to ruin your family by paying out huge dowries. And I was told that they say, well, you know, we don't want to buy into that system now. We have our own friends, and we can. They're starting to arrange their own marriages, which, of course, is against the traditional technique, which is that the parents arrange a marriage with someone in your social category or of your social status. But so, in some ways, it may be that some of those distinctions are breaking down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's still, putting it in context of well over a billion people, that's still a fairly small number. But it is happening more and more.
Yeah, and whether or not that spreading liberality would be accorded to those at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder.
Well, that is right. But I was told it is becoming much more of a meritocracy.
Okay.
And if you have the skills and the education, even if you're a Dalit, you can get jobs and you can become more independent.
Yeah.
That would be primarily in urban areas?
Primarily in urban, yeah. In rural areas, you didn't have those opportunities.
Margaret.
I was just at a conference with Gene Houston, who works with smaller communities in India. And she works kind of like mythological, and so she was in this small community, rural community. And I don't know what part of India. One was showing I can't pronounce it, but it's a certain mythological story.
Ramayana?
Yeah, that's what it reminds me of, exactly. And halfway through, one woman in the room got up and said, "We need a new story."
I know why.
This story is not us.
Right. That's like the Lutheran church.
Yeah.
The reason is that Ram and Sita, those are the two. Ram is the perfect man.
Right.
Sita is the perfect woman. And lo and behold, the story unfolds such that Sita is completely subservient to Ram.
Exactly.
And almost worships him.
Yeah.
And apparently Indian mothers, even to this day, even in Canada, will say, and I've read a number of books on this, be like Sita.
Yeah.
Be like Sita.
Yeah.
And so there's a feminist rebellion saying, the hell with Sita, I don't want to be like her.
No, it's not true. My husband is a bum,
she said.
Yeah, so here in the back.
Could you say a little more about this notion of Dalit theology?
The little I know about it is that it is pridefully being put to the fore by Indians who want to do their own theology different from mission theology. Mission theology, my sense is that it's mostly otherworldly. It's more Pentecostal oriented. So there's the emotionality of Pentecostalism. And it is somewhat ignoring then of the social economic plights that should be addressed. And so the kind of theology they're doing is mirroring the social activism of liberation theology in Latin America, but the critique is being aimed at the caste system itself.
Okay. And this is a question that I'm totally ignorant. In what sense is that theology?
Oh, in the sense that they like in Latin America, they see Jesus as someone who was intolerant of brutal injustices, and therefore as a liberator. Yeah.
What would be the impact of Dr. Ambedkar University?
Yeah.
This is raising the level of intellectual opportunity. And yet I wonder if your degree were from that university, would that perhaps count against you?
As
in competition for jobs.
Yeah. Say what you know about it, because I know there is a university.
About it, that's why I'm asking.
Oh.
I know that it's there, and clearly it's designed
to uplift.
Counteract,
yeah,
the intellectual monopoly of the high castes.
Right.
And I just wondered how it's doing.
I don't know. I just know of it that it exists. And so let's assume Dalits would be attracted to it, and they'd get a good education. The cynic in me would say that's fantastic, but they'd still carry around the Dalit taint, I would think. Like, for example, Luther Paul, he has a doctorate in Hebrew Bible from Serampore University, a Christian school, and his book is published, but he still carries this Dalit taint. That is, he's not dragging around behind him because he brings it to the fore. This is a Dalit issue. These are Dalit in an activist thrusting way. I'm not sure that's a good question. No? Can you pull yourself up by your bootstraps and actually beat the system? I don't know.
What distinguishes, like, what? I mean, do you walk down with a mark?
Good question, yeah.
Can you pass yourself off?
Well, all I know is what I've heard, and that is that, look at my face. The bone structure is this way. Mm-hmm. People look at me, they know I'm broad-cheeked, broad-chinned, I'm a Dalit. Look at my color. So there's a color issue, too, because Varna, so the caste system is also called the Varna system, which is color. Varna means color. So, from light-skinned to dark, not uniformly, of course, mirrors the caste system. And so, how you talk. In Andhra Pradesh, for example, there's an Andhra way of speaking and there's a Telangana way of speaking now, and the state is split. But I didn't know that. But apparently he can tell a Telangana accent. Mind you, they're the Dalits. They're both Dalits. So even the two Dalit groupings have different accents, different cuisine, different eating habits, food choices. For women, there's even the threading on a sari is distinctive from one region to the next. Whether that's caste, I don't know. But you get in that kind of soup of cultural complexity, and the discernment is not easy unless you're a part of it. So I think caste people do... Well, and then the Brahmins wear a thread. So Luther Paul would always be saying, look, when we're getting train tickets, look, there's a Brahmin thread. And wanted me to know that that's a Brahmin caste person. And they wear it under their shirt. Goes over the shoulder. You know, like this. You can buy them and put them on.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Why would you, you know? Why would you put it up on? Why wouldn't Luther Paul put it on?
Yeah.
And walk into the tent?
Yeah.
It's unnatural.
It's kind of Karen.
It's also, we know it from the name, too. Like,
yes, good point.
And like, my parents know some people who came, but honestly, I'm not Hindu, but we still have a caste system. It's not as bad, but it's still there. And like, there was a family that had moved from India, of lower caste, and they switched their last name here. And you can trace it back, and then everyone found out.
So they switched their name here to avoid.
Yeah,
being categorized.
Yeah, but they switched it to a higher caste.
Oh.
Make it a higher caste. But then the trait, like, no one could figure it out. And, like, how the Eastern thing is so, like, close to everyone knows. It eventually, like, they said that they were lower caste. And so, like, there's this issue with, like, if, like, my parents are higher caste and if I was to marry someone lower caste, it doesn't, like, it's very normal.
It wouldn't work, yeah.
And so their daughter had married someone of higher caste. Well, they thought it had equal caste. And they were forced to get divorced because
She was a divorce. Yeah, excellent point. Luther Paul told me about the name thing. I did some Googling on names, and there's books written on this apparently of high caste names, Brahmin names, Vaishya names, Shudra names, and all the subcastes. Reddy, for example, is high caste, REDDY, and that they own a huge pharmaceutical company in India. Not that you can't be rich and low caste, but it's less likely.
I saw him. Yeah.
I'd just like to follow up the theology question I was asked here. I have a brother who's presently in Indiana, and he's raising the funds to support students at an Indian school.
Okay.
And as little as I know about Christian missions in India, I do know that historically Christian missions were always involved in education. It was always for the better life. It wasn't a heavenly thing, it was right here and now. That was the focus.
Yeah.
And certainly that was my experience in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I was involved in that.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering now that you made that distinction, but all the things I know about Christian missions in India is exactly education and raising the
mm-hmm.
people to give them an opportunity for a better chance to survive in this world.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. And I'm getting it secondhand, right? But I'm getting it from Sati Clark, for example, who's doing this Dalit theology, and from other people at United Theological College, and from Gurukul, where Gurukul in Madras is... Have you been there?
No, I've not heard about it.
You've heard about it, yeah. It's the center, one of India's centers, if not the center, for Dalit theology. And the books I've got from there I've been reading. And they're the ones who make this contrast. So exactly what they mean, I'm thinking more of... It might be an evolving reaction against I'm not sure the language, evangelicalism that's coming into India, spirit Christianity, Pentecostalism, which is sweeping Latin America, Vinny, from Calgary, the Indian, I think he's Indo-Canadian evangelist who's gone to India. I was asked a number of times in India, what's his name, Benny?
Benny Hinn.
Do you know Benny Hinn? And I said, no, I never heard of him.
You never said you were healed by him?
No,
you missed this opportunity.
So these movements that come into India have like 50,000 people out in the open, and there's preaching and healing. And so maybe that's what they're concerned about, and they want more of a less imported and more indigenously developed theology that takes serious the Dalit roots of 50-80% of Christians. Yeah, that's my sense. But I hear what you're saying. Yeah, I didn't mean to caricature Christianity generally as not concerned about social advancement, for sure.
Educational work and medical work are always the basics for me.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, my old friend Dr. Sood, who is a blessed memory, Dr. Sood used to always argue that the caste system, I mean, he gave a kind of classical Hindu argument for the caste system and its virtue. I mean, it's a structure,
mm-hmm.
and which creates stability and all those sorts of things.
It sure does.
So, you know the argument.
Yes.
But he also argued that India has been colonized by the Mughals, and then by the Brits for this long period of time.
Yeah.
And that colonization completely warped the caste system.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
Well, he would say that the notions of untouchable come from there. Or he did, he argued there all the time. That this is not... It did not mean that before colonization. So I'm wondering, in your own view,
just a minute. So Hindu or so Muslims reinforced or brought about the subjugation.
Colonization is a fundamental corruption of the society, and that it created, particularly with the untouchables, it created this group of people that were seen to be, or that were given such a hard time and put down in this way that you described. You would argue that prior to colonization, this was not the case.
Sounds a little self-serving to me.
Well, of course. But,
yeah.
But the other side of it, when you flip the question around, is, I mean, you sound very much like you really would like to see the caste system done in.
Well, actually, I've heard some Hindus say that caste.
How do you see this?
I've heard some Hindus say that caste system also is a vestige of the past, and it needs to be abolished.
The system itself.
The system itself.
Not just the way it's understood.
Right.
Because Sood's argument.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But it sounds like the way you described it, that was a creation myth. So that's not a colonization story.
True. It's textually embedded in many different places in Hindu literature.
Yeah, so like
the caste system.
Yeah, 1300 BCE.
Yeah. Well, and you've got, you know, I could have gone
so
on.
So that's not a colonization story. The caste system wasn't created by colonization.
No,
the caste system created that. But it's a question about how it's understood.
Right.
And that it comes to be understood in a very different way as a result of this appallingly long period of colonization.
But some of the quotes that you gave, I don't think came from colonization.
Way before.
Yeah, but I mean,
in terms of the attack on the Asuras. I mean, the other thing is the laws of Manu, the Manu Shastras.
Yeah.
These are law books. I think they date to about, not that far, 600 AD, I think. And they're still informative of Hinduism. And in there, in the reading of them, especially in terms of the status of women, your hair curls, if not falls right out. So, you know, and those are still...
You obviously haven't read it.
Yeah, that's true. Point. Got me on that.
Strains his hair.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a lot of caste descriptions of the vocations that different castes ought to take up in there as well, and that's pretty solidly embedded culturally. So I don't think that's a consequence of foreign colonization.
Hmm.
Anyway, yeah.
Were you going to say a little more about this question of how little impact the Christian mission movements have had in India? You mentioned that at the beginning, and I can't remember if you meant to get back to that.
No, the sense that I have is that the Vaishnavite tradition within Hinduism, which is the worshipping of Vishnu, generally there's three major theistic streams within Hinduism. There's Vishnu, Shiva, and then the Shaktas, or the goddesses. And that Vaishnavite stream has as a central, well, it is about the need to restore Dharma in the world. Dharma is like natural law. It is the way things should be, Dharma. You're born with a particular Dharma also, you and I. And we ought not to fiddle with that. We ought to go with that. Those predilections were born. That's our Dharma. But the universe has Dharma as well. And so the entire ritualistic system of Hinduism is to maintain that Dharma in terms of sacrifice at the sacred fire and so on, and prayers, asking the gods to maintain balance, harmony. At times it gets out of whack. And it gets out of whack because of people not following their Dharma. So a cobbler tries to be a king. That's not good. It shakes the universe, kind of. So, at times, God needs to do something. Vishnu. And what he does is he incarnates himself into the world in the form of a man. And the man is birthed in North India in a place called Vrindavan. And that's where he grows up. And there's legends about, there's stories about him growing up, miracles he performed, his teachings as he became a young man, massive followers. So he doesn't die on a cross, but that whole story of God needing to intervene to save the world is a central theme within Hinduism. So when the poor missionaries come in, I don't know this firsthand, but you can only imagine. You know, Jesus came into the world to save the world, and Hindus would go, no problem. And
another incarnation.
Yeah, and there's nine incarnations. So now, and then Ram is one. We talked about Ramayana. Ram is one. And then there's half man and half animal incarnations as well. And every child knows the stories of these incarnations. So I think that's part of the reason. And there are Vaishnavites who would just add Jesus to one more. And but then the missionaries say, no, only Jesus. There's only one time.
Don't be silly.
Don't be silly.
Thanks so much, Jack.
Yeah.
Great. I've been charmed in Hindu homes that I've had the privilege of being in Canada. There's often a room set aside for worship, for the altar. And often you will find even Warner Solomon's head of Christ.
Yeah.
As one of the enshrined deities.
Yeah. Yes.
And I remember the first time, it was with Dr. Sood, that we had a discussion about this late in the evening in his home, where he said to me, "But David, you need to understand that we love Lord Jesus."
Yeah, I've heard that too.
"And we love Lord Vishnu. And we love Lord Krishna."
More the better.
And on one occasion, I was asked by the Hindu priest in Edmonton to come and give a talk during Lent at the Hindu temple. Because now they're living here, they wanted, of course, to know. We need to know, he said. We need to know the worship of Lord Jesus. You know, we love Lord Jesus. So please come, David. You're our friend. Come and talk about it. So I knew what would happen. So I sat in front of the deities, the five deities. It's a wonderful place with my friend Sushil Kalia, and gave this talk as best I could to speak about the particularity of Lord Jesus. And they were so pleased, and they gave me a beautiful filigreed crucifix as a gift, and then a citation. Lots of misspellings on it, but, you know, I was a cosmic person, a man of the universe, and all that sort of stuff. It was lovely. And then Sushil Kalia took everything I said and just whirled it around and wrapped it up in this absolutely beautiful Hindu package. it was wonderful and charming, and it is a deep part of the Indian sensibility. So I wanted to point out that on Thursday at 9:25, we have a seminar, a Rounding Center seminar on Rethinking Public Space in the Light of Emerging Pluralism. It is given by Simon Lazare, who just finished his doctorate in the UK, and will be down here for that. That's going to be in C103. Also, next Monday, the second in our series on Pietism, at Messiah Lutheran Church at 7 in the evening, on spiritual transformation or colonization, looking at Pietism in North America. And then, coming down the pike, we're delighted this year that we can have Brian Evans give two lectures on Chester Ronning, one on Ronning as politician and another one on Ronning as diplomat. This is my way of trying to bully Brian Evans into getting his book on Ronning done. I do this with various people, including my good colleague, Dietmar Mundel, who has several books in him which require my bullying, which is completely unlike my character.
I know it's highly effective. Yeah.
So, thanks so much. Good to see you. Thanks again.